portion of John's gospel detailing the events preceding and culminating in Jesus' death on the cross. 2 weeks ago, we watched as Jesus voluntarily submitted to arrest in the garden. Last week, we witnessed Jesus' interrogation by Annas. This was not a formal trial, but something like a preliminary examination to get Annas' approval to prosecute Jesus. You remember that Annas was a very powerful man in the religious leadership. That he gave such approval is indicated by the fact that he sent Jesus to his son-in-law Caiaphas, who was serving as high priest at the time. John doesn't give us the details about Jesus' appearance before Caiaphas. You can find that in some of the other Gospels. Rather, he tells us simply the outcome, and that is that Caiaphas sends Jesus to Pilate. Jesus' appearance before Pilate is found in John 18:28 through 19:16. And the narrative is comprised of seven scenes. And the scenes alternate between those outside of the praetorium and those inside. We will consider the first three scenes today and the final four scenes in our next message on John. I've entitled this sermon, Trial of the King, because the kingship of Jesus is a key theme in John's telling of the story. An important literary device often employed by John is irony, and we'll note that at several points today. The ironic twists often clue us into the deeper meaning of what is transpiring. In this series of scenes, we will see Jews who are desperate to have Jesus killed. We'll see Pilate vacillating between a sense of justice and political expediency. And we'll see Jesus maintaining his poise and turning the tables so at times we wonder just who really is on trial. All of this is taking place because Jesus is committed to carrying out the saving mission that is going to take him to the cross. So beginning this week and including in our next message, we will look at the story of Jesus before Pilate, scene by scene. And we begin today with the first three scenes, which we will identify simply by their alternating locations. Scene 1 in verses 28 through 32 take place outside the praetorium. Scene 2 then goes inside, verses 33 and through 38, and scene 3 outside, verses 38 through 40. As we follow Pilate's moves back and forth, let us see what we learn about Jesus and his kingship. We begin with the first scene outside the praetorium, beginning with verse 28. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium, and it was early morning. But they themselves did not go into the praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Last week, we noted that the story of Jesus appearing before Caiaphas was bracketed by the story of Peter's denials. The last we heard about Jesus was in verse 24. Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Again, as we mentioned, John doesn't tell us about that little trial, but our first verse today evidences its outcome. Jesus has been found guilty, and therefore, he is led from Caiaphas to the praetorium. The Greek word praetorium originally referred to the tent of the commanding officer on a field of battle. But by the first century, it came to be used of the Roman governor's residence. At this time, the governor of Judea usually lived in the praetorium at Caesarea, a port city on the Mediterranean that was named for the emperor, Caesarea, named after Caesar. It was a much more pleasant place to be on the coast. But at busy times, like the Jewish festivals, the governor would stay in Jerusalem with extra troops as reinforcements in case any trouble arose. Remember, the Romans are the occupying forces of the land. John tells us it was early morning, which places this at about 6 a.m. That might sound like a very early time to be requesting a civil trial, but it was typical Roman practice to begin official business at sunrise. While the Jews were clearly in haste to have Pilate rule against Jesus, their timing was not all that unusual. About 3 hours had elapsed since Jesus had been taken to Caiaphas, enough time for his trial before the Sanhedrin to have been conducted. And now Jesus is being transferred from a Jewish religious court to Roman civil jurisdiction. John says of the Jews escorting Jesus, But they themselves did not go into the praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Now here is the first example of Johannine irony in the story. These Jews are fastidious about maintaining ritual purity. They refuse to enter Pilate's headquarters for fear that such a move into a Gentile home would render them unclean during the Passover festival. But at the same time, they are more than willing to engage Pilate in the unjust killing of Jesus. Their external show of piety is really a sham, as their actions will demonstrate. These are hardly people committed to the weightier matters of the law, like truth and justice. They put on a religious show, even as they seek to arrange what really will be a murder. Verse 29, Pilate then went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" John names Pilate for the first time with no further introductions, a sign that his first readers would know all about this person who's so prominent in the story of Jesus' passion. Pilate was the governor of Judea from AD 26 through 36. He was probably familiar with Jewish ritual concerns by now, so he goes outside to meet the delegation. He understands they won't come into his dwelling. He may well have been expecting them if he was aware of that cohort of Roman soldiers involved in Jesus' arrest the night before. Most of Pilate's speech throughout this episode is in the form of questions, and we encounter the first one here. He asks, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" Verse 30. They answered and said to him, "If he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." The Jewish leaders seem to think that this response should be sufficient. They've already tried Jesus, and they expect Pilate to just come along and sort of rubber stamp their verdict without asking any questions. It all seems rather presumptuous on their part. Beyond that, there is an indication of their intentions in their speech. The word translated delivered is elsewhere in this greater context translated betrayed. It has been used 8 times in this Gospel of Judas. What we see is that the Jewish authorities have taken over the role of Judas as the betrayers of Jesus. But if they expected Pilate just to play along with their game, they were sorely disappointed. Verse 31, then Pilate said to them, "You take him and judge him according to your law." Therefore the Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." Pilate, initially at least, is not interested in playing a role of being a rubber stamp for the Jewish authorities. His reply is if they want to do things their way, then they should just go ahead, but leave him out of it. They have their own law. Why do they need recourse to Roman law? And they answer that question when they say, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." You see, the Jewish authorities have already concluded that Jesus is guilty of a capital offense. This is what they have been desiring for some time. Back in chapter 11, it was Caiaphas who had suggested that it would be better for one man to die for the nation than for the whole nation to perish. And John had commented then, from that day on, they plotted to put him to death. Now Jesus has had a trial before Caiaphas himself, that one who had earlier indicated this was the direction to go. A trial, not surprisingly, that resulted in a guilty verdict. The problem is that the Jews have no authority to carry out a death sentence. This is something that only Romans can do, and the Jews want this done officially, the Roman way, which means crucifixion. According to Deuteronomy 21:23, this would make Jesus accursed, which is just what they wanted. Here was a man who had some popular support. They wanted the footnote in history to be that he was accursed through death on a cross. But it was not just the desires of the Jewish leaders at work here. John provides an editorial comment, verse 32, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. Jesus has been anticipating not only his death, but the very form of his death throughout the gospel. For instance, back in chapter 3, verse 14, we read, "And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up." 8:28, then Jesus said to them, "When you lift up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am he." Chapter 12, verses 32 and 33, "And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all peoples to myself." Then John adds, this he said, signifying by what death he would die. Jesus has spoken on the matter. And so Jesus' word, just like the word of Scripture, must be fulfilled. John's statement once again affirms Jesus' authority and reminds us that in all of this, Jesus is no passive victim. He has long known about his Father's plan that called for him to be crucified. What had long been anticipated will now soon come to pass. And again, there's irony. The Jewish leaders are sinning as they seek to manipulate Pilate to crucify Jesus, but their sin ultimately serves God's purposes. John's comment brings scene one to a close, and that brings us to scene two inside the Praetorium, beginning at verse 33. Then Pilate entered the Praetorium again, called Jesus, and said to him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" So the scene shifts from outside to inside. Pilate leaves the Jewish leaders outside, and he calls Jesus to himself, and he asks a question, "Are you the King of the Jews?" For the Jews, the main charge against Jesus would have been blasphemy. But that would not have been a capital offense in a Roman court. Now, Pilate may have been aware of the popular messianic expectations. Recall how Jesus fed 5,000 people, and what did they do? They responded by they wanted to make him a king. Now, that would have been the kind of thing Pilate would have been concerned about, a rival king, either to himself or to Caesar. What else could prompt the Jewish leaders to think he would execute the one brought to him? And so this is the charge they have leveled against him. Not blasphemy, he wouldn't care about that. But the suggestion that he is claiming to be a king in contrast to Caesar. Yet, he takes one look at Jesus and says incredulously, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And in the Greek here, the "you" is emphatic. And I think we're supposed to see this way. The bound peasant standing before him hardly looks like a threat to the empire. And yet Pilate's dismissive words introduce the subject of Jesus' kingship, a subject that involves more truth than he realizes. Verse 34, Jesus answered him, "Are you speaking for yourself, or did others tell this about you?" Note that Jesus doesn't answer Pilate. Instead, he turns the tables, and he asks Pilate a question as if Pilate is the one on trial. Jesus wants to know whether Pilate has come up with his idea of Jesus' kingship on his own, or if others, presumably the Jewish authorities, have reported it to him. Verse 35, Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" Pilate answers Jesus' question with a question of his own that expects a negative response. "Am I a Jew?" Well, of course, Pilate isn't a Jew. And the implication is that Jewish affairs are of no direct interest to him. It's only because of the Jewish leaders that he is being forced to deal with Jesus, to whom he says, "Your own nation and the chief priest have delivered you to me. What have you done?" And again, this word "delivered" is the same as "betrayed." We have this connection with Judas in their acts. Verse 36, Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from here." Now, Jesus doesn't appear to answer Pilate's question directly, but in a sense he does. What has Jesus done? He has brought a kingdom into this world that has its origin from outside of this world. It is not the kind of political kingdom that Pilate has in mind. If it were a kingdom of this world, then Jesus' followers would have taken up arms in his defense that he might not be betrayed into the hands of the Jews. But remember that Jesus had told Peter, when Peter did brandish his sword, to put his sword back in its sheath to avoid just that kind of charge. No, Jesus says, my kingdom is not like that. In fact, my kingdom is not of this world. Now, as readers of John's Gospel, we know that Jesus himself is not from this world, that he was sent by the Father for the purpose of bringing his heavenly kingdom to earth. We know this, but Pilate doesn't. Verse 37 begins, Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you a king then?" Pilate hears Jesus speak about a kingdom, and so his mind goes back to the original question. And again, this is the only one that would have any legal standing in Roman jurisdiction. So he asks, "Are you a king then?" And the verse continues, Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." You say rightly that I am a king. Actually, the word rightly is not there. It's in somewhat implied. He says, you say that I am a king. Now, with these words, Jesus doesn't deny his kingship. But he does suggest this is Pilate's way of speaking. This is what you say. Now, of course, the irony is that Judas is a king, but he's not the kind of king that Pilate would think of. And the difference in Jesus' kingship is expressed in the way he describes his purpose. He is not on a revolutionary political mission to upset Rome and hegemony in Judea. Rather, Jesus says, "For this cause I was born, and for this cause I came into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Now, Jesus' talk of being born and of coming into the world and of truth takes us back to John chapter 1. "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, glory as the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." We have that incarnation coming into this world and that expression of truth. Or chapter 1:18, "No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of Father, he has declared him." Jesus tells Pilate he came into the world to bear witness to the truth. The truth that he and he alone knew from the Father. But this is not a matter of some kind of abstract religious speculation. It was revelation that centered in Jesus and his saving mission. So Jesus could say, "I am the truth. No one comes to the Father except through me." To know truth is to know Jesus. So Jesus tells Pilate, "Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And you see, this is an implicit challenge to Pilate. Will he be on the side of truth? Will he show that by listening to Jesus? Or will he turn from truth to listen to the clamoring of the Jewish leaders? So again, we see that Pilate, in a sense here, is on trial. We can only be disappointed by his response. Verse 38, Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" Perhaps Pilate was the first postmodern. This is one of the most important questions anyone can ask, yet Pilate does not seem to ask it expecting an answer. He seems to speak these words to brush aside what Jesus has said to him. And ironically, truth incarnate is standing before him. Pilate does not even wait for an answer to his question. Instead, again, the scene shifts to our third scene, again, outside the praetorium. For verse 38 continues, "And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, 'I find no fault in him at all. But you have a custom that I should release someone to you at the Passover. Do you therefore want me to release to you the King of the Jews?'" Pilate may not have understood Jesus, but he certainly didn't think he was guilty of a capital crime like revolutionary treason. He seems to think Jesus had made that clear enough. So he goes back outside of the Jewish delegation and he declares, "I find no fault in him at all." So Pilate thinks he may have a procedural move that is going to defuse the situation. There was a custom of releasing one prisoner to the Jews at Passover time. Perhaps this was sort of a nod playing on the theme of the first Passover as liberation from the bondage in Egypt. Sort of an olive branch that the Romans would send to the Jews when they were gathered for the feast. If the Jews would request the release of this one known as their king, Pilate could release an innocent man, but without fully exonerating him. He could release anyone. His conscience would be satisfied, and the Jews just might accept this as well. So he makes the proposal. "Look, you have a custom. I can release someone to you. Do you want me to release your king? Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" But what seemed like the perfect political solution for Pilate falls flat. Verse 40. "Then they all cried again, saying, 'Not this man, but Barabbas.'" Now, Barabbas was a robber. So the Jews emphatically refused Pilate's proposal, arguing that he release Barabbas instead. And the word for robber here, it is a word that can mean insurrectionist. And the picture we get from the other Gospels confirmed that this man was truly a revolutionary against Rome. So confronted with a king and a robber revolutionary, the Jews choose the robber. As commentator Herman Ritterboss notes, the Jewish leaders, by choosing a violent revolutionary over Jesus, discard all pretense that their indictment against Jesus arose from concern for maintaining political and social order. You see that? They've sent Jesus saying, look, he's a rival king. He's someone who's going to be a threat to Roman power. When it comes down to it, they say, oh, no, no, release this guy. Oh, by the way, he is an insurrectionist. He's really one who is a revolutionary against Rome, but that's the one we want released. But the irony runs even deeper than that. You may know that the word bar in New Testament names is the word for son. So, for example, elsewhere we were told that Simon Bar-Jonah is Simon the son of Jonah. Well, that's the case here as well. And the literal meaning of bar, Abbas, is son of the father. Now think about that. Throughout the gospel, John has stressed over and over again that Jesus is son of his father in heaven. And this is central to his identity. But the Jews here reject the true son of the father in favor of one who merely bears that name. And that brings us to the end of this third scene, the final scene that we will consider this week. Next time, we'll look at the remainder of this story of the trial of a king. John has already introduced us to the key characters, and he's laid bare their motives. There are the Jewish authorities who earlier that morning had conducted a religious trial and found Jesus guilty of a capital offense. They want Jesus crucified, the most humiliating death for a Jew, but they don't have the power under Roman rule to do it themselves. So they take him to the Roman authorities. Of course, the Romans care nothing about Jewish religious scruples, so the Jews must suggest that he is guilty of some political crime. Pilate wouldn't care about blasphemy, but he would be concerned if some rival king were on the rise. This is what the Jews suggest, but they are disingenuous. If they were really out to protect the Romans from revolution, they would hardly call for an insurrectionist like Barabbas to be released instead of Jesus. Their one goal, their long-standing desire, is to see Jesus killed. Then there's Pilate. He has no interest in entering into these Jewish religious matters. He would be happy for the Jews to take Jesus back and deal with him themselves. But the suggestion that Jesus may have revolutionary motives leads him to interrogate Jesus. And when he does so, Jesus answers with questions that suggest Pilate is the one on trial. And in a sense, he is. He is confronted with Jesus' claims to bring in a kingdom not from this world. He is challenged by Jesus' statement that those who are of the truth listen to him. Will Pilate listen to Jesus? Will Pilate find a place in Jesus' kingdom? Well, the evidence suggests that Pilate will do neither. His desire is for a politically expedient solution to this whole affair, preferably one that would spare Jesus, whom he has found to be innocent. And this is what he is working towards, but it just doesn't work out that way. And of course, there's Jesus himself. He is no helpless victim. He is the interrogated who turns interrogator of Pilate. He is the one who does not fear an earthly kingdom like Rome because he has come to establish a heavenly kingdom. He is the one who will not resist on the road to crucifixion because this is the road the Father has given him to travel. Yes, Jesus is the true Bar Abbas, the true Son of the Father. And as Son of the Father, he is committed to fulfilling the saving mission given to him by the Father, even though it required death on the cross. So I would ask you, where do you find yourself in this story of the trial of a king? Are you like the Jewish authorities, focused on external signs of religious piety while still committed to a life of sin, of going your own way? Are you here in worship today because it is what makes you look good, even though your heart may be far from God? If so, I warn you that that is ultimately the path to destruction. External religious observance can all be a sham. It certainly was for those Jews who were so meticulous about purity laws that they wouldn't step into a Gentile residence. one who sought to lie in order to put Jesus to death. So I'd warn you, do not go their route. But then are you like Pilate, looking for the path of political expediency that will please others enough so they leave you to do your own thing? When you hear of a kingdom not from this world, do you dismiss it as otherworldly nonsense? When you are challenged to find truth in Jesus, do you shrug it off with a postmodern dismissal of the very concept of truth itself? Well, I warn you not to travel down that route. In a story filled with ironic twists, John is showing you Jesus as the true king, the king who came from heaven to accomplish salvation for all who will be in his kingdom. Have you found a place in that kingdom by identifying with Jesus through faith? Jesus told Pilate that all who are of the truth listen to him, listen to Jesus. Are you of the truth? Remember, Jesus declared, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." The call of this narrative is to listen to Jesus, to recognize him as the truth, to bow before him as your king, and to find your life within the kingdom that is not of this world. When you do these things, you will not follow in the footsteps of the Jewish authorities who condemned Jesus or of Pilate who didn't know what to do with Jesus. Instead, you will follow in the footsteps of all who have had their lives transformed by acknowledging their sin, their need of a Savior, and by coming to Jesus in faith. So seek first his kingdom, and you will find peace that this world cannot give, and you will gain eternal life that this world cannot take away.